In our study tonight, we're going to be in Revelation chapter 17. We're going to be studying about the scarlet woman upon the scarlet beast, as you see on the screen. But before we do that, I want to go back and review our minds a little bit. Some of you have commented about how beneficial you think that the reviews are of the book of Revelation. I try to do that when we start a new chapter especially. And I always try to, when we start a new chapter, to put some source material on the board. I've added some to this. So one in particular, The Apocalypse of St. John. This is online. It's Henry Barclay Sweet. It's a commentary that has been used in our study and by others, and I referenced some of it. And so I wanted to add that to our list. You might find that some of this material will be helpful to you if you're looking to compare views, the early date and late date. I would recommend Robert Harkrider's material, either his workbook or his commentary, or then taking the early date, Foy Wallace and Arthur Ogden take the early date. So if you want to do some comparing and contrasting, that would be a good place to do it. Regarding the whether or not there was, in fact, a Domitian persecution, there is an exchange between Arthur Ogden and Farrell Jenkins. That's in Searching the Scriptures. You can research that and find it online, I think, June 12th. And so this will be on our website for your convenience. Now, in our study, to review just a little bit, we've noted that the first 11 chapters set the stage for the things that are explained in greater detail, beginning in chapter 12. Chapters 1 through 11 discuss the state of the church on the earth at the time that John is writing. And John is told about some things which must shortly come to pass. It's addressed to the seven churches of Asia Minor. We noted that the seven churches of Asia Minor are characteristic of problems that would exist throughout the churches, especially during John's day. In chapters 4 and 5, a grand scene of the throne room of God to help us to see that God is in control. The fourth chapter, we see praises being given unto God for who he is and what he's done. And then in chapter 5, first two-thirds of that chapter, the heavenly beings are singing praises unto the Lamb, for he is worthy to take the book, as we'll see in the sixth chapter, because he has died for us. And then in the latter part of chapter 5, praises being given to God and the Lamb. Then in chapters 6 through 11, we see the opening of the seven seals. Now, when you come to the 11th chapter, you know how the story ends, but you don't know why. When you read the last paragraph of the 11th chapter, we see that God's people are victorious, and those heavenly beings, the 24 elders who sit before the throne, fall down before God, and they worship, and they're giving thanks to God for the great things that he has done and the conquest that has been gained. Excuse me. Then beginning in the 12th chapter, we see in the backdrop the source of this conflict between God's people and the devil. The backdrop is the war between God and Satan. And that we see in the 12th, 13th, and 14th chapters. And those three chapters become very important to us because they help us to see the identity of certain characters that are discussed in the remainder of the book. For example, in the 12th chapter, we note that the great dragon is identified as the serpent, and he's cast down to the earth. In the 13th chapter, we're introduced to two beasts, the sea beast and the earth beast or land beast. And we know from a comparison in the 13th chapter, the first beast, the sea beast that's described, is the same as the beast that Daniel describes in Daniel chapter 7. And we identify then the earth beast or the land beast as equivalent with the false prophets that is spoken of in the 16th chapter of Revelation and in verse 13. And we noted that that represents those who were charged with the responsibility of enforcing paganism, which would include emperor worship, which was the thing in that day. Then we talked about the earth beast given authority to put to death those who would not worship the beast, that is Rome, in verse 15. And then we saw the beginning in verse 16 of chapter 13 going on into then the 14th chapter, a discussion of the mark of the beast and the mark of the lamb and of the father in the 14th chapter. So that contrast continues. And in our studies, most recently, we've been talking about the 15th and 16th chapters, the 15th chapter becoming the introduction of the pouring out of the bowls of wrath, then for the 16th chapter. Now in the 17th chapter and the 18th chapter, we're going to be reading and studying about the fall of Babylon, the great harlot. And I know that that, much like the mark of the beast, is of great interest to a lot of people, and rightly so. But the identification of who the great harlot is becomes very germane to our study of essentially the rest of the book. And so much to be said about that in the 17th and 18th chapters. We know that John's vision of the great harlot, and I'm going to just kind of paraphrase this, in the first six chapters or first six verses of this chapter is a contrast of two women and two cities. And we'll talk about that as we get to that. And furthermore, in this chapter, the latter half of it is an explanation, essentially, of the first half of it. It's the explanation of the mystery that is being discussed regarding the fall of the great harlot, Babylon the Great. So these two women, these two cities, we want to identify. We discussed a woman in chapter 12 to represent all of God's redeemed ones. We noted that that was the redeemed ones of the Old Testament and then added to the redeemed ones of the New Testament. Now, in chapter 17, there are several positions that have been proposed about who this woman is in chapter 17 that we're introduced to in the first few verses. And I want to get this in front of you, and then we'll proceed with some greater detail. Some believe, and Foy Wallace in his commentary believes, that this constitutes apostate Palestinian Jerusalem, the head of hostile Judaism. So, of course, Wallace takes the early date and believes that what's being prophesied in the 17th and 18th chapters of the book of Revelation has to do with the fall of Jerusalem. Some take the position, John T. Hines, if any of you have, Richard, I think you do, and I know some others do. I have the Gospel Advocate set of commentaries, and John T. Hines is the one who writes the commentary on the book of Revelation. And he takes the position, number two here, that the book of Revelation refers to the apostate church, which developed in the centuries following Pentecost. In other words, it applies to the fall and collapse of Roman Catholicism. I don't believe that. I think these first two positions I don't accept. I think there are flaws in both of them, especially in the second one, because the second position takes the position, takes the theme of the book, I should say, outside of the context of things which must shortly come to pass. These would be things that would come to pass way down thousands of years. Well, that wouldn't help those brethren. The third position that's taken is that the book of Revelation and what's discussed in particular in chapter 17 and 18 references the fall of pagan Rome, which then in turn represents the world of lust and all of its evil. And just for a concise reading, Homer Haley's commentary on these pages will identify that position. Robert Harkrider, I think, does quite a good job trying to develop that position in his commentary. So you may want to do some reading on that might be helpful to you. So there's a lot of material, and I don't want you to think, well, I've got to read all of this stuff that we saw on that first slide in order to understand the book of Revelation. I don't believe that. some of that is helpful. It's helpful especially to me because I'm trying to teach the material, but you don't have to read all of that to read and understand the book of Revelation. I think that the Bible itself is most helpful in interpreting these things, particularly when we compare it to Daniel. Yes. I don't know who I'm talking to.
It's Randy.
Randy, Child. Thanks.
Can you explain number one a little bit more?
Okay, very simply, this is a quotation, I believe, from Brother Haley's book, Apostate Palestinian Jerusalem, the head of hostile Judaism. Brother Wallace took the position that the book of Revelation is to be dated with the early date prior to A.D. 70, and that the source of persecution that's being discussed throughout the book of Revelation primarily is at the hand of Judaizing teachers. Now, there's no question that Judaizing teachers were persecuting Christians. I think that's evident as early as Acts chapter 3, 4, and 5, that the Jews were persecuting Christians. We see that as early as the development of the church. But whether or not that's what the subject matter is for the book of Revelation is open for discussion. Brother Wallace thinks that that's the application of the book of Revelation. Others I know and think a lot of do also. And I've learned a lot by reading Brother Wallace's commentary, but I believe he's missed the application of the book. And I'll show you why, and think I have showed you why in some previous studies. From Daniel in particular, chapter 7. We'll look at Daniel chapter 4 tonight and compare it with Daniel chapter 2. And I think that's the background for my position on that. But does that help just a little bit? He uses, or Brother Haley uses a lot of terms to describe Brother Wallace's view, but very simply that the book of Revelation is prophesying of the fall of the city of Jerusalem in AD 70.
Yeah, that's a little clearer. Okay. What's a little confusing is when you say Judaizing teachers, that it kind of makes me think of Christians that are teaching circumcision.
Well, yes. Yes.
But really, you're talking about the Jews, like the hostile Jews.
The hostile Jews, the establishment.
Yeah.
Ones that wanted to kill Paul.
The ones that wanted to kill Paul. Yeah, that's it exactly. I don't know who said that, but that's exactly right. Yeah. The ones that wanted to kill Paul. The ones that wanted to, or did imprison and beat the apostles in Acts chapter 4 and 5. That's who we're talking about that Brother Wallace thinks is the persecutor or tormentor of the church. Now, the thing that while we're just discussing that, we'll discuss it in more detail as we get to the next few charts. But while we're discussing that, one of the biggest flaws that I see in that position is that when you consider the city of Jerusalem itself, permeating throughout the Roman world and persecuting Christians throughout the Roman world, I don't believe they had that influence. I'm just not convinced that ancient Judaism had that widespread of an influence. Now there's much more to be said about that, and we'll look at some of it as we get to it in the charts. Any questions or comments here before we proceed? Okay, so we understand basically then the three views that are taken regarding this. These two women and the two cities that we're going to be discussing, this too is from Brother Haley's commentary, just to help you to find it if you're studying from that. He says that in chapter 17, the discussion has to do with the harlot and her seductive wiles. In other words, she's crafty. And I think we see that evidenced in what Rome did. We see that that's true in what the Jews did, but I think it applies to our text here with what Rome did. And considering this section, and I think this is important too to our discussion tonight and for the next few weeks when we look at chapter 17, verse 1 through chapter 19, verse 10, that constitutes a section. And we're going to see that this judgment that is going to be discussed in the 18th chapter is going to be the fall of the harlot. And then in the 19th chapter, it concludes, that scene somewhat concludes with rejoicing over her fall and the victory of the saints. Now, we're going to note as we come to the end of the 19th chapter, what's done with the harlot and her seductive ways, and as a consequence of the things that was done. And I think that we'll see that that better fits the discussion pertaining to the fall of Rome than it does to the fall of Jerusalem. But be that as it may, I know some folks that take the early date position, and I even like some of them. So I'm not going to fall out with you if you take that early date position. But be that as it may. Now, here's a scene that some think depicts, you can look at the artwork down at the bottom and know the source of it, but it depicts the scarlet woman sitting on this scarlet beast that has seven heads and the blood of the saints and so forth and so on. And we'll talk more about that as we get a little further on in the imagery of the first few verses. But this gets in front of you some of the vivid scenes or something like this that John was seeing in this vision. Now, again, before I get to the actual text, are there any questions or comments? All right, let's look at verse 1. In verse 1, it says, "And there came one of the seven angels." Now, we don't know which one. It says, "There came one of the seven angels that had the seven bowls and spake with me, saying, Come hither, and I will show thee the judgment of the great harlot that sitteth upon many waters." In verse 2, I'm going to read the first five verses. It says, "With whom the kings of the earth committed fornication, and they that dwell in the earth were made drunken with the wine of her fornication. And he carrieth me away in the spirit into the wilderness. And I saw a woman sitting upon a scarlet colored beast, full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns." And then in the fourth verse it says, "And the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet, and decked with gold and precious stone and pearls, having in her hand a golden cup full of abominations, even the unclean things of her fornication, and upon her forehead a name written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of the harlots and of the abominations of the earth." Now, that's the first five verses of the text, just the reading of it. I wanted to put this note over to the side because sometimes we need to define our terms. The word abominations is defined by this author to mean that which is detestable, that which is to be loathed or abhorred. And I want to note that God's view of this harlot that you saw in the previous picture, and what she represents was loathsome, abhorrent, disgusting, detestable. The point being, when God uses this term abomination in the text, I don't know of a stronger word that could be used to set forth what he or how he views such unauthorized, ungodly practices. Now, the term harlot is used in this passage, and we're introduced to that in verse 1. "Come hither, and I will show thee the judgment of the great harlot that sitteth upon many waters." When you today think typically of, I'm just going to try to paint a picture, of somebody who practices prostitution. I want to go back, if I may, to this picture, because I think it displays the scene better. Notice how she's dolled up. When you think today of somebody that is a prostitute, sometimes you think of somebody that is behind the mask, somebody that's all dolled up and painted up. And you read in Proverbs chapter 7, for example, of the woman who had on the attire of a prostitute. So the idea of a stereotype picture of a prostitute is displayed in the scriptures. And for our purposes here, we want to note how that this woman is dolled up to become appealing to accomplish her purposes. You'll notice again how that reference is made in verse 4 to the woman's attire. She's dolled up, if you please, much like what we read in Proverbs 7, in purple and scarlet, decked with gold and precious stones, of pearls. She has on the attire of a harlot, and the purpose is to accomplish the things that she would desire to accomplish. So you see why this word is used. This is an abomination unto God. All the things that you can picture that are bad, that's what's characterized in this expression here in verse 5. Now, I think it's crucial for us to get a little bit of background study about Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots, and the abomination of the earth. When we use the term Babylon, especially in this text and in the book of Revelation, we need to have a fairly accurate picture from Old Testament scriptures about how Babylon is described. And to do that, I've put some passages, not by any means all of them, but put some passages, and we're going to look at these somewhat contextually, but these are the specific verses. I want you to note Proverbs chapter 16, however, beginning at verse 18, where the wisdom writer said, "Pride goeth before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall." Now, we know what a proverb is. It's a general statement of truth, a saying of wisdom, if you please. Now, when we go back into the Old Testament and we read about the Old Testament Babylon, turn with me, if you will, to the Old Testament book of Habakkuk. If you look at Habakkuk chapter 4, I want to begin the reading at verse 2 to set the stage about what Habakkuk is about. Keep in mind that he is the prophet of God who's concerned about the southern kingdom of Judah. The wickedness, that should be chapter 2, verse 4. Yes, chapter 2, verse 4. You got to watch me. What's on the board there? Habakkuk chapter 2, verse 4. Knowing who Habakkuk was, the prophet was concerned about the condition of Judah. He approaches God with the question, how long is this going to go on and judgment not be forthcoming? And God told him that, I'm going to tell you, but though I tell you, you won't believe it. And when he told him in verse 6, I'm going to raise up the Chaldeans, he describes them rather extensively, and I would urge you to read that description there beginning in verse 6 through verse 10 or through verse 11. And in that context, we see why Habakkuk is so concerned, because his next question is, why are you going to use them? They're worse than we are. So he's perplexed about why God would bring up the Chaldeans, the kingdom of Babylon, and use them to destroy his people. And God, and I'm paraphrasing now, don't worry about the Babylonians. I got a plan for them. I'm going to destroy them too. But to characterize the Babylonians in Habakkuk chapter 2, verse 4, it says, "Behold, his soul is puffed up. It is not upright in him. But the righteous shall live by his faith." Now, we're well acquainted with the latter part of verse 4, as we quote from Romans chapter 1, verses 16 and 17. The righteous shall live by faith. Point being, Habakkuk, you need to listen to what I say and believe that I'll take care of my end of it. But the first part of that verse describes the attitude of the Babylonians. "Behold, his soul is puffed up. It is not upright in him." To the point, Babylon was characterized by a spirit of pride and arrogancy. And we know that pride and arrogancy, God has said, do I hate. You can read that in Proverbs chapter 6, there beginning, what is it, about verse 9, where we read the list of things that God hates. Proverbs chapter 6, somewhere along about verse 9. So this tells us a little bit about the background of the kingdom of Babylon. Now I want to turn to Isaiah and read a little bit in Isaiah chapter 13, 14, and I have chapter 47 on the screen as well. But let's start in Isaiah chapter 14. Isaiah chapter 14. In this text, if you'll pick up the reading with me, beginning about verse 3, I'm going to skip through some verses, but in verse 3, it says, "It shall come to pass in the day that Jehovah shall give thee rest from thy sorrow and from thy trouble and from the hard service wherein thou wast made to serve, that thou shalt take up this parable against the king of Babylon." Now, that sets the stage for us as to what we're talking about. Isaiah is writing about Babylon. And you'll notice as you drop down to verse 12, picking up the reading again at verse 12, it says, "How art thou fallen from heaven, O Lucifer?" Now, I'm going to use that term because that's how the King James translation reads. If you're reading from the American Standard, and I think from the New American Standard, that's not what it says. It says, "O day star, son of the morning." But the King James translation uses the term Lucifer. But whether you read from the King James or whether you read from a more modern translation, who is being discussed is crucial. With the use of the term Lucifer or the use of the term day star, who is Isaiah discussing? Now, I know, and you do too, that for many, many years, perhaps in all of our studies and times gone by, you hear the word Lucifer, and what comes to mind? That term is frequently used to describe the devil, but it's not used in the Bible to describe the devil. Now, let's just take that home. The word Lucifer is not used in the Bible to describe the devil. It's used in the King James translation of this text to describe the king of Babylon. Now, you just read the chapter and you'll see that's so. The thing that becomes so confusing to so many is we have been so conditioned through the years to accept certain things as true without ever studying them. And that's a pitfall, a snare we don't want to be caught up in. The term Lucifer in the King James translation in Isaiah chapter 14, verse 12, is used to describe the king of Babylon. You say, well, how do we know that that's so? Start reading in verse 3, and you'll see that that's the context that's being discussed. Take up this parable against the king of Babylon. He's talking about the fall of Babylon. Now, as you keep reading, I'm sorry, I heard somebody. No? Okay, as you keep reading in verse 12, it says, "How art thou cut down to the ground that didst lay low the nations?" Who did that? Babylon did. In verse 13, "And thou saidst in thy heart, I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. And I will sit upon the mount of congregation in the uttermost parts of the north, and I will ascend above the heights of the clouds, and I will make myself like the Most High." What was it that the king of Babylon wanted himself to be? How did he see himself? As God. You'll notice further in this text, he said, "Yet thou shalt be brought down to Sheol, to the uttermost parts of the pit. They that see thee shall gaze at thee. They shall consider thee, saying, Is this the man that made the earth to tremble and did shake kingdoms?" What's going to happen to the king of Babylon? He's going to fall. Pick it up again, if you will, at verse 21 and see if the thought continues in your mind. "Prepare ye slaughter for his children, for the iniquity of their father, that they rise not up and possess the earth and fill the face of the world with cities. And I will rise up against them, saith Jehovah of hosts, and cut off from Babylon name and remnant and son and son's son, saith Jehovah. And I also will make it a possession for the porcupine and pools of water, and I will sweep it with the besom of destruction, saith Jehovah of hosts." What's he going to destroy? He's going to destroy Babylon and the kingdom of Babylon, the king of Babylon. That's what the chapter is about. Now, having said that, let's turn back just a little bit in the book of Isaiah And go back, if you will, to Isaiah chapter 13. In Isaiah chapter 13, we've used this passage before in previous studies, and I want to call your attention to verse 1 of Isaiah chapter 13. In Isaiah 13, verse 1, the writer says, "The burden of Babylon, which Isaiah, the son of Amoz, did see, set ye up an ensign upon the bare mountain, lift up the voice unto them, wave the hand, that they may go into the gates of the nobles." Drop down again to verse 6. "Wail ye, for the day of Jehovah is at hand, as destruction from the Almighty it shall come. Therefore shall all hands be feeble, and every heart of men shall melt, and they shall be dismayed. Pangs and sorrow shall take hold of them, and they shall be in pain as a woman in travail, and they shall look in amazement one at another. Their faces shall behold faces of flame. Behold, the day of Jehovah cometh, cruel with wrath and fierce anger, to make the land a desolation and to destroy the sinners thereof out of it. For the stars of heaven and the constellations thereof shall not give their light, and the sun shall be darkened in its going forth, and the moon shall not cause its light to shine." Verse 13, "Therefore I will make the heavens to tremble and the earth to be shaken out of its place in the wrath of Jehovah of hosts in the day of his fierce anger." His fierce anger against whom? Babylon. Do you see that? Chapter 13, verse 1. This chapter is discussing the fall of Babylon. It's interesting to note in verse 10 how that the stars of heaven and the constellations shall not give her light. Now here in the desert, and in particular here in California, where we sometimes see the results of wildfires. Have you ever in the late evening looked to the west and you couldn't really see the sun because of the smoke? And at night you couldn't see the stars because of the smoke? What happened to Babylon? It was destroyed. Now read with me further in this same chapter, Isaiah chapter 13, beginning at verse 17. In Isaiah 13, verse 17, it says, "Behold, I will stir up the Medes against them, who shall not regard silver, and as for gold, they shall not delight in it. And their bows shall dash the young men in pieces, and they shall have no pity on the fruit of the womb. Their eyes shall not spare children. And Babylon, the glory of kingdoms, the beauty of the Chaldeans' pride, shall be as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. It shall never be inhabited, neither shall it be dwelt in from generation to generation. Neither shall the Arabians pitch tent there, neither shall shepherds make their flocks to lie down there. But wild beasts of the desert shall lie there, and their houses shall be full of doleful creatures, and ostriches shall dwell there, and wild goats shall dance there. And wolves shall cry in the castles and jackals and the pleasant palaces, and her time is near to come. Her days shall not be prolonged." What is Isaiah saying in verses 17 through 22 that's going to happen to the pride of the Chaldeans, the city of Babylon? What's going to happen to it? Somebody say it. It'll be utterly destroyed. Now, as you read in history concerning this ancient city of Babylon and the kingdom of Babylon, as you read in secular history and as you read in biblical history, it was a grand place. But this writer tells us that it will be so destroyed that the Arabs would not pitch their tent there, and the shepherds would not make their flocks to lie down there. That city would be so destroyed that the wild beast would overtake it, that the wolves shall make the castles their dwelling places and the pleasant palaces. And this was soon to come. And who was going to do it? Well, he says in verse 17 that the Medes, who couldn't be paid off, they wouldn't regard silver or gold. They would come up and they would destroy Babylon. Now, we know how that came to pass in both secular history and in biblical history. We can read how that Cyrus, the king of the Medo-Persian Empire, conquered the city of Babylon. And we know how he did it. He diverted the waters of the great Euphrates River around the city of Babylon. so that he was able to march his army up the dry riverbed into the city of Babylon and took the city. Now, again, I want to call your attention to this text of Isaiah 13 and 14 and note that Lucifer is not talking about Satan. This text is talking about the fall of Babylon. Now, I've got one other passage on the board that I want to look at, and that's from Isaiah chapter 47. In Isaiah chapter 47, you'll note beginning at verse 1, we'll again skip some verses for sake of time. But beginning in verse 1, it says, "Come down and sit in the dust, O virgin daughter of Babylon. Sit on the ground without a throne, O daughter of the Chaldeans. For thou shalt no more be called tender and delicate." Dropping down to verse 5, "Sit thou silent and get thee into darkness, O daughter of the Chaldeans. For thou shalt no more be called the mistress of kingdoms. I was wroth with my people. I profaned mine inheritance. I gave them into thy hands. Thou didst show them no mercy. Upon the aged hast thou very heavily laid thy yoke. And thou saidest, I shall be mistress forever, so that thou didst not lay these things to heart, neither didst remember the latter end thereof. Now therefore hear this, thou that art given to pleasures, that sittest securely and sayest in thy heart, I am, and there is none else beside me. I shall not sit as a widow, neither shall I know the loss of children. But these two things shall come to thee in a moment, in one day, the loss of children and widowhood. In their full measure shall they come upon thee. In the multitude of thy sorceries and the great abundance of thine enchantments, for thou hast trusted in thy wickedness. Thou hast said, none seeth me. Thy wisdom and thy knowledge, it hath perverted thee. And thou hast said in thy heart, I am, and there is none else beside me. Therefore shall evil come upon thee. Thou shalt not know the dawning thereof. The mischief shall fall upon thee. Thou shalt not be able to put it away, and desolation shall come upon thee suddenly, which thou knowest not." And what's Isaiah telling Babylon of? You who say, I am, and there's none beside me. You who say, my children will live forever. I'll never be a widow. It's not going to happen. You're going to be the subject of God's wrath, and you'll lose your children. You'll be named in widowhood. And the judgment of God will come suddenly, and it will be complete. Now, that's what's said about Babylon's pride. Do we see that? Now, when you come over to the book of Revelation, is it a surprise that the term Babylon is used to describe those who are tormenting God's people? Some say, oh, that's Jerusalem. No, I don't think so. I think it's a greater empire than Jerusalem. The context up thus far, at least in my judgment, has been discussing the fall of the great empire of Rome. And that's the empire that Daniel said in chapter 2 and chapter 7 that would be brought down. All right, well, there's another thing we need to know about Babylon's past and why that term is used. For this point, turn with me to the book of Jeremiah. Jeremiah, and let's notice in chapter 50 and 51, and I'm going to yield to some of you, if you would, to read some of these passages for me. Jeremiah chapter 50. Randy Childs, you who read, would you read for me chapter 50, verses 1 through 10? Jeremiah 50, verses 1 through 10.
The word which the Lord spoke concerning Babylon, the land of the Chaldeans, through Jeremiah the prophet. Declare and proclaim among the nations. Proclaim it and lift up a standard. Do not conceal it, but say, Babylon has been captured. Bel has been put to shame. Marduk has been shattered. Her images have been put to shame. Her idols have been shattered. For a nation has come up against her out of the north. He will make her land an object of horror. There will be no inhabitant in it. Both man and beast have wandered off. They've gone astray. In those days and at that time, declares the Lord, the sons of Israel will come, both they and the sons of Judah as well. They will go along weeping as they go, and it will be the Lord their God they will seek. They will ask for the way to Zion, turning their faces in its direction. They will come out that they may join themselves to the Lord in an everlasting covenant that will not be forgotten. My people have become lost sheep. Their shepherds have led them astray. They have made them turn aside on the mountains. They have gone along from mountain to hill and have forgotten their resting place. All who came upon them have devoured them, and their adversaries have said, "We are not guilty, inasmuch as they have sinned against the Lord, who is the habitation of righteousness, even the Lord, the hope of their fathers." Wander away from the midst of Babylon and go forth from the land of the Chaldeans. Be also like male goats at the head of the flock. For behold, I am going to arouse and bring up against Babylon a horde of great nations from the land of the north, and they will draw up their battle lines against her. And there she will be taken captive. Their arrows will be like an expert warrior who does not return empty-handed. Chaldea will become plunder. All who plunder her will have enough, declares the Lord.
Isn't that profound and that plain? And I want you to notice that in this prophecy of Jeremiah, he's speaking concerning the fall of Babylon, but he's also speaking concerning the return of God's people to the land. Now, that occurred during the days of Ezra and Nehemiah, as we read of the remnant returning to the land, just as God had promised through the words of the Old Testament writer Moses and Deuteronomy chapter 30, verses 1 through 10. But in these verses, you see the fall of Babylon. And the thing that I want you to note in these verses is the many images, the idolatry that characterized Babylon. While you have your Bible open to the 50th chapter there, Randy, would you go ahead and read for me verse 38, please?
Jeremiah 50, verse 38. A sword against the oracle priests, and they will become fools. A sword against her mighty men, and they will be shattered.
Something's not right. That's not 50, 38.
That was 50, 36.
Okay.
38. A drought on her waters, and they will be dried up, for it is a land of idols, and they are mad over fearsome idols.
All right. Our point is the land was full of idols, but we referenced a few moments ago this passage when we noted that the Euphrates River would be dried up, and Cyrus, who led his army on the dry riverbed right into the city and conquered the city of Babylon. But our point here is in this passage that the city was full of idols. And Randy, if you would, while you're there, chapter 51, verses 17 and 18.
Sure.
I know we're running out of time.
51, 17 and 18. All mankind is stupid, devoid of knowledge. Every goldsmith is put to shame by his idols. For his molten images are deceitful, and there is no breath in them. They are worthless, a work of mockery. At the time of their punishment, they will perish.
Okay, I'd like for you to read both of these chapters in their entirety, chapter 50 and chapter 51. And I see on the board I've got a comma there, Richard, that don't belong. I have a semicolon that doesn't belong. The comma does belong, so if you would correct that before it goes on our website, that would be good. I just noticed that. You'll notice also, by the way, in verse 47 of this chapter, therefore, behold, the days come that I will execute judgment upon the graven images of Babylon. And you'll see it again in verse 52. The point that we're trying to establish is that characteristic of Babylon's past was not only their pride and arrogancy, but Babylon was filled with idolatry. In chapters 46 and 47, you see further evidence of that. In fact, if you'll note in the text of Isaiah, chapter 21, verses 8 and 9, we have on the board, and he cried as a lion, "O Lord, I stand continually upon the watchtower in the daytime, and I am set in thy ward whole nights, and behold, there cometh a troop of men, horsemen in pairs," and he answered and said, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon, and all the graven images of her gods are broken unto the ground." Now you see where the language of John comes from, Fallen is Babylon. We've noted that earlier in our study of the book of Revelation, and we will have occasion to revisit that. But we also want to note, before we completely run out of time, characteristic of Babylon in their conquering other nations was their cruelty. Now, I called your attention. We won't turn back to it and read it from Habakkuk chapter 1. Habakkuk chapter 1, yes, verse 6. For lo, I will raise up the Chaldeans, that bitter and hasty nation. In fact, you might read the next several verses following that through verse 11, or on down through verse 16, if you want to make that one quotation, chapter 1, verses 6 through 16. But it shows the cruelty of the nation of Babylon. And then, Randy, the passage that you read a few moments ago from the New American Standard, I'm glad I asked you to read that. Chaldea will become a plunder. All who plunder her will have enough, declares the Lord. The point being is that when Chaldea was conquered, the spoils of the city would be enough to make the other nations rich. And so that's the characterization of Babylon in the past. And this will be a good place, Richard, for us to just stop, because it gives us a backdrop against which the language that is used here in verse 5 is to be studied. When he talks about Babylon the Great, the mother of the harlots and of the abominations of the earth, there's a reason why that language is selected. We see how that term is used in times gone by. And we see how the term harlot is used. We'll have to talk about that next time. But I want to note that the term harlot is not used just in one instance, either Old Testament or New. It's used in a number of instances. And we'll talk about those places and the passages in our study next time. Now, let me stop sharing the screen. And I hope that you don't think that I belabored the point of Babylon. Maybe I did. I don't know. But when that term is used in such a prominent way in the book of Revelation, we need to have a knowledge of how it's used in the Bible, because that use of that term surfaces in the book of Revelation, to talk about pride, arrogancy, to talk about cruelty, to talk about idolatry. And I think we're going to attempt to make an application of that term to ancient Rome and what they were doing, and the paganism that was characteristic of the time, and that it was inclusive of emperor worship. And so we'll have occasion to talk about that hopefully next time. Any comments or questions?
Mickey?
Daphne?
Yeah. So while we were doing all the reading and studying and stuff like that, I'm using a Net Bible app on my phone app. And so what they do is they go through and they explain the translations and the original language and the context and stuff like that. It's interesting. But when you were doing the one in where it was talking about the Lucifer, the son of morning and stuff like that, it explained that a lot of those images and the things it was talking about were referring to Babylonian gods,
yeah,
their mythology. The sons of Ei were the astral bodies, and he says, I'm going to build my throne above that.
Yeah.
And so he's drawing comparisons between their mythology and their gods and God himself.
Right.
So even more, and he lumps the king of Babylon in there because he's part of their mythological thing. But he's talking about that whole structure of paganism that was rampant in Babylon at the time.
Right. And that's why I think that we see the comparison here in the book of Revelation.
Yeah.
I'm so tempted, and I wish we had about 3 hours in this class. But when you go back to the 13th chapter in verses 11 and following, you see the paganism. That's characteristic of the empire that's discussed in verses 1 through 10. And so the emperor and worshiping the empire is just lumped into this package of paganism, which was dominant at the time. That's another reason I'm not persuaded that he's discussing the city of Jerusalem. Those things just weren't characteristic of Jerusalem.
Yeah, that's what the Net people said, was that referred to the king of Babylon too.
So. I think that's right. Yeah. Yeah. And that's a surprise to a lot of folks when you use the term Lucifer from the Old Testament text. what was that, Isaiah 14 or Jeremiah 50? Yeah. I forget where I was.
I think it's Isaiah 14.
Isaiah 14, I believe. Yeah. But when we today use the term Lucifer, I would almost guarantee you that 9 out of 10 people, if you walked up to them on the street and said, who's Lucifer? They'd say, that's Satan. And many of us who profess to be Christians, we've been so influenced to think that way too by the world that we live in. And, the denominational aura that seems to be prevalent. And it's not. The term is used to describe the king of Babylon.
Mickey?
Yes, sir.
I think it's interesting to note, just as a side note, that if you actually look up the Hebrew word that's there, it is, as you say, not even a 42nd cousin to anything that could be even remotely translated Lucifer.
No. No. No, I think what Daphne has told us about the mythology of the day is probably right on target. Any other comments or questions?
Yeah, so Mickey, you're talking about the Medes and the Persians, right?
Yes. Yes. The Persians and the Medes combined forces, and under the leadership of Cyrus, they conquered the city of Babylon. In fact, if memory serves me correctly, Isaiah is the prophet that spoke concerning that and named his name, Cyrus. And that prophecy by Isaiah.
Isaiah 49.
Is it 49 or 44, 45?
Okay. You may be right.
Yeah. 45. Beginning at verse 1.
45.
Yeah.
But it's both 44 and 45.
Yeah, the tail end of 44 and on into chapter 49. It's, it tells us that in verse 27 that the river would be dried up, and Cyrus is named as the shepherd of God who would bring these things about. And you'll note in chapter 45 verse 1, Cyrus would open the doors and would be responsible then for the rebuilding of the temple. And that's how it came to pass. And the irony of Isaiah's prophecy regarding the fall of Babylon and the naming of Cyrus was that Isaiah prophesied about 200 years before Cyrus was born. There wasn't any such thing as a Medo-Persian empire. Babylon was the empire. And Isaiah has prophesied that Babylon will fall and Cyrus will do it. And Cyrus will allow the people to go home, as we read, and rebuild in the city of Jerusalem, and all that before there was even a kingdom of the Medes and the Persians. Any other questions or comments? Okay, well, we're out of time, and so we're going to conclude. But before we do, as we always do, we're here to try to help each other to go to heaven. And if there are those who are listening to us in our study tonight that understand you need to do something about your soul, we can help you with that. If it's in initial obedience to the gospel, we'll be happy to baptize you into Christ right now. We'll just hang this up and go to the building, take care of that. And if you're joining us tonight and you realize there are things in your life that are not right, as one who is a citizen in God's kingdom, recognize the privilege that's extended to us to correct the things that we have in our life that are amiss. The privilege of prayer, the forgiveness that's offered if we're willing to repent. We'd be happy to help you in any way that we can to accomplish those things.